This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Thanks for tuning in to 93.3 CFMU Radio. This is Progressive Voices. I'm Riaz Sayani-Mulji. Today I'm joined in studio by Harry Fear. Harry is a journalist, a documentary maker, and an activist. He runs a well-known YouTube channel in which he has filmed pieces on the Iraq War, Islamophobia in Western society, and more. Harry was recently in Gaza during Operation Pillar of Cloud. Harry also served as an on-the-ground correspondent for Russia Today during Pillar of Cloud. Since then, Harry has embarked on a worldwide speaking tour, sharing what he saw in Gaza as an eyewitness. Harry, thanks so much for being here today and joining me on the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Harry, so to begin, I want to know, what were your initial impressions of Gaza when you arrived? Describe the population and tell us about the different communities you visited.
Well, I think that the problem really about Gaza when you go is that you're left with a big gaping hole of not really knowing actually much about it. And this is obviously one of the fundamental problems that Gaza faces itself finds itself in, is that much of the world doesn't really know what's going on. So I went with, even I considered myself at the time well-informed, what turned out to be very stereotypical and simplified images of basically rubble everywhere, poverty affecting, people in such a widespread way that, it's like kids with their ribs showing and stuff like this, and people walking around looking like zombies because of post-traumatic stress disorder. And actually, none of these things were really true. And where I was staying, and I ended up staying, and where my home is these days in Gaza, is actually built up, and it could very well be Cairo. But most of the strip is basically refugee camps, and it's pretty much what you would imagine for in a refugee camps, which have been there for decades. They're not tents, with plastic tarpaulins, but they are terribly small homes, terribly crowded together with basically no real amenities at all. And today, it's raining, and it's last night it was below 0 degrees in Gaza. And so you can just imagine, if you don't have really any protection from that, you're living in a refugee camp. Most of the population are. It's not looking good. So the point is that the Palestinians appeared ostensibly going to, when I arrived in Gaza, to not be walking zombies and to be trying to continue their life the best they can. But when I first arrived, it was kind of like, wow, this is the place where all of this suffering is happening. And that, Gaza is a household name in the world, whether people understand it or not. People know that the place exists. And it's so small. I mean, you can go from the south to the north in 45 minutes. Yet there are 1.6 million Palestinians jam-packed inside. So these are some of the things which really struck me.
When you got to Gaza, the economic siege, the blockade on Gaza, described as a medieval-esque siege, how did you see that directly affecting the population? Give me some examples.
Well, I mean, obviously the point is that as a youth myself, actually, technically speaking, the youth unemployment is 75%. So my Palestinian friends basically don't have any jobs. And they're qualified, educated, fluent English speakers, vastly intelligent, but they've really got no economic hope, actually. And you can just imagine what that has in terms of a psychological effect and social effect and, familial effect. I mean, if you go to, for example, the marina area in Gaza City, you can meet fishermen who have PhD engineering degrees because they can't get a job for their qualification, so they end up doing something basic and practical to try and support their families. So these are some practical examples. But let's take my next door neighbor, for example. He's got four brothers. In fact, one was just killed, so he now has three brothers, civilian killed in collateral damage. And actually, among those three remaining brothers, only one of them is the breadwinner. So he is basically helping the family survive, all of the children, all of the parents and grandparents and his brothers and sister. And this is actually a normal story. One person in a family unit will have a job and they end up providing for everyone. So this is the kind of image you get. And this is universal, this kind of story. This is not an aberration. So really we can say that the kind of ordinary people's lives are really being suffocated. Despite this, they have an amazing ability to remain psychologically strong, if not economically strong and physically secure. And they remain sort of steadfast psychologically. But I mean, in technical scientific terms, it's looking pretty bad, yeah.
Yeah, so Harry, how long have you been in Gaza prior to Pillar of Cloud beginning?
Well, I spent actually 7 weeks in Gaza last year before the operation began. The most recent time was I was there for 8 days before the operation began. So, I mean, we did not actually expect that the operation will happen. So it was obviously an absolute horrendous shock. And, I mean, what we were doing in those 8 days was to document the ongoing violence, which is there was basically at that time there was a cycle of violence between Israel and the Palestinian groups. And so we were documenting that in Gaza, and we were documenting the the killing of innocents in Gaza before the operation started. Actually,
so tell us what you saw. We all heard about the different methods used against the Palestinians, the different areas bombed, whether it be hospitals, media stations, schools. But what was it like being in the community, not knowing whether or not a land invasion was going to take place, for example, or not knowing where you're staying that night would even be safe?
Well, I mean, I think the most obvious thing to say is it's basically absolutely bloody terrifying. And even as an international journalist, that doesn't give you any absolute protection or security. I mean, I live in what is basically the second safest building in Gaza, in what is basically a kind of zone for internationals de facto. And so it's probably one of the safest areas in Gaza. But even this did not, provide us with a shield against Israeli attacks, because they're explosions just behind where I was live on TV. So the point is that we didn't feel any security as internationals, and the Palestinians didn't. And as you alluded to, the ground invasion was something that we feared from the very beginning, because there were Israeli murmurings about this and threats, actually. At some points, there was a leafleting saying that we are going to invade with a ground operation, evacuate your home and go and stay with family, whatever, over there in this area of Gaza instead. So I want to say that when you're put under that kind of psychological terror, basically, and Palestinians will be quick to say that this is clearly state terrorism that they're feeling, when you're put in that kind of circumstance, what you have to do, psychologically speaking, is, if you can, and Palestinians do manage to, is to remain strong and try and be constructive. So try and provide for your family, try and stockpile food, fuel and water, try and keep your children psychologically stable under continued bombardment and etc. So it actually is a kind of full-time job, even being imprisoned in your own home, trying to seek refuge in a bomb shelter, and there aren't bomb shelters in Gaza. The bomb shelters are people's homes. So for me, it was a matter of reporting full time and putting my energy into that to try and deal with the psychological stress. But really, it is a stress to hear bombardment around your home for 8 days. I mean, me personally, having been there, I mean, I'm a journalist, but I can report that clearly the force that was used was reckless and disproportionate, and is clearly, technically speaking, state terrorism, because it's terrorizing a population with a particular explicit political objective. So technically speaking, it does fall into this category, unfortunately.
Tell us about some of the violations of international law, the war crimes that you saw.
Well, I mean, it's kind of sad, but it's kind of where do you start? And I said, during just immediately after the war, you can go to any spot in the Gaza Strip as an investigator and start documenting. Well, let's take, for example, the five most obvious massacres that took place, particularly of children in Gaza during the 8 days. So the operation lasted 7 days and 3 hours, 8 calendar days, started on the 14th of November. And throughout this time, there was most prominently the Al-Dalou family massacre. And Israel started in this operation, Pillar of Cloud, this 8 day war, a new policy, new military policy of targeting the homes of Palestinian resistance fighters rather than military sites. So with the Al-Dalou family home, it was trying to basically kill a member of Hamas's militant wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades. But the point was that the guy that they apparently intended to kill, and they've admitted to this situation, wasn't even in the family home. And so basically they massacred all but one member of his family and others visiting the home, including four children, four women, including one elderly woman. And so that is very obviously from, the United Nations point of view, other international bodies, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, etc., Israeli human rights organizations, and obviously Palestinians, a bloody massacre, which should go answered in international law. But that is one of five obvious ones similar to that. There's also, this is basically, explicitly speaking, this is the targeting of civilians, basically knowing that civilians are going to be killed, which they knew. And they basically admitted to. So there's also the targeting of journalists. There were three journalists that were explicitly assassinated during the 8 days. Israel maintains that they are not legitimate journalists because of who they're working for, the stations they're working for, because they basically Israel doesn't like the associations that this these channels have. It's basically like targeting the journalists of CTV and CBC and saying, well, actually, we just don't like these channels. They're not legitimate. Bad luck. So it killed two cameramen and one senior TV channel executive. In one case, it just blew up the car of the cameraman, which was marked as a civilian press car, the same kind of car that I travel around in the Gaza Strip, by the way. So the point here is you can see that no one is really safe, actually, under these circumstances. And Israel is happy to induce massive collateral damage, including children, as a matter of routine basis to conduct its targeting operations.
As a journalist, you started off streaming live what was happening from your own channel, and then Russia Today contacted you and you became their on-the-ground correspondent. How difficult was it trying to convey what was happening in Gaza while Western media was constantly bringing in people from the pro-Israel lobby to contest what you were saying? How frustrating was that for you to get your message out?
Actually, I didn't find this frustrating, but this gave me an increased responsibility because I was really, to be honest with you, one of a handful of people who were able to speak in native English, native British English, to the Western world about what's going on, actually, as a, if you like, a foreign correspondent. And this just made me more determined to not sleep, basically, and carry on doing the job. But even with the point about the whole Western media bringing these Israeli spokesperson constantly and almost agreeing with them on TV and nodding along and yes, 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 sir, to the Israeli state spokesperson, which is obviously highly journalistically embarrassing for them to do, this was kind of, in a way, as I said, more of a motivation. But in a way, I tried to be very honest in my journalistic approach and say, well, look, the Palestinians are calling this a massacre. It doesn't matter what the Israeli spokesperson says. The civilians are terrorized, and therefore this basically looks like state terrorism to the Palestinians. You know, and the point is that it's difficult to talk about this in Canada because it doesn't really resonate that, you know, five massacres took place in 8 days, journalists were blown up, media buildings were targeted, children were killed for no reason with no explanation given. You know, most of those killed were civilians, about 2,000 were injured, overwhelmingly women and children. It doesn't really actually hit home until you hear the names, ages and faces in the stories. But the point is that when you're there and it's happening around you and it's happening to people that you know or people you bumped into or acquaintances, etc. I mean, a friend of mine was killed during the war. It really resonates that this is basically, from the Palestinian point of view and pretty much factually, a kind of massacre taking place, actually. And this is really what it felt like. So then to hear the totally absurd justifications given, it's fairly easy to combat, actually, because the international law says that you can't use reckless and disproportionate force. You can't use internationally prohibited weapons under, you know, densely populated civilian conditions and etc. So actually, it wasn't particularly hard to combat many of these points.
Harry, I want to move away from Pillar of Cloud for a second, although this is heavily related, and speak about the democratically elected government of Gaza, Hamas. Now, these elections did take place a few years ago. What I want to know is, when you were in Gaza, how much support do you feel Hamas has amongst the population there? Are they enjoying widespread support right now?
In short, they are enjoying widespread support. In the most recent days and a couple of weeks, we've seen an increase in political expression freedom, including demonstrations for large rallies of hundreds of thousands of Gazans, Palestinians in Gaza, supporting other rival movements as well. But excuse me, Hamas still enjoys a vast amount of widespread social support. Its mandate is now actually 7 years old in 2013, but it still has a form of legitimacy, generally speaking, according to the kind of, you know, what you pick up from Palestinians, that they know that the problem is not really Hamas or particular Palestinian faction in terms of not having good political representation, if they think that it's not good political representation. It's basically the context that it falls under, which is occupation, besiegement, and bombardment. And Palestinians are not sort of, you know, they haven't been hoodwinked about that. They're well aware of what the real problem is actually affecting their social conditions. So some people come up in Gaza with, I mean, in one particular case, a girl asked me to make a report about the satellite signal being interrupted on her TV every evening because of Israeli drones flying over. And I said, well, you know, this isn't actually quite as important, you know, as children being killed. But she holds, you know, Hamas responsible for that because Hamas hasn't done something to improve the satellite TV signal. So I kind of hear these sorts of things against Hamas. And they're not really... generally, the kind of complaints about Hamas are not strategically leveled against Hamas in the context of the Israel-Palestine conflict. They're very much domestic issues, which, as I said, most people seem to be aware is basically in root cause as a result of the general international situation.
And when we look at colonialism historically, there is that classic move by the colonial power of divide and conquer. Few know that in Canada, our second largest military commitment is Palestine. There's a mission called Operation Proteus in which Canada supplies weapons and training to Fatah in the West Bank to arm and train their security forces. Some have said that this is a good example of divide and conquer in which the imperial colonial powers throw their support behind one
definitely
group. So is that what you make of the situation?
Absolutely. I mean, in the West Bank, which I haven't been to now for a couple of years, but it's an absolute matter of fact that the Palestinian police force in the West Bank basically collaborates with the Israeli occupation, the illegal Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories in the West Bank, according to international law and the United Nations. And in many cases, they act actually more ruthlessly, you know, qualitatively speaking, than the Israeli occupation soldiers. And as you say, they are basically supported by the West, you know, materially, as you just explained, by the Canadians. So, yeah, absolutely it is. And obviously, I mean, listening to the recent Canadian foreign minister statements about Hamas and Israel's operation against Hamas, total, you know, Hamas are not worth even thinking about, let alone talking to, is their position. But they were democratically elected. They actually still have a kind of dwindling mandate. So this is obviously insane, you know, strategic position. You've got to talk to the people who have been elected. So it is absolutely divide and rule. And if you think about it, even basically geographically, there are two bits of Palestine which have two basically different administrations as a result of this policy of divide and rule.
All right, Harry, just to wrap up here, I want to know, from what you've seen, how resilient are the Palestinians as a people, a community, a nation, in resisting the decades of oppression, occupation, colonialism, violence that they've been facing?
Well, this is the most surprising thing about the Israel-Palestine injustice, is that the Palestinians have gone through the most really unimaginable tragedies and sufferings of life over a decade's time period. And they actually still believe that they will get their self-determination and their, you know, their internationally legally provided rights back, and that they remain hopeful and steadfast at a profound spiritual level and at a basic practical social level as well. And they called this, you know, social resilience steadfastness sumud, steadfastness. And this is their Palestinian struggle, their principle, that we will not give up, we will remain one unit, and that we will get our freedom back however long it takes.
Inspirational words, Harry. Thanks so much for joining me on the show today. Now, just for our listeners who are interested in learning more about what you've been doing, maybe watching some of your YouTube videos, can you share your website, your YouTube channels?
Of course. To see the YouTube videos, people can go to www.harryfear.tv. That's FFox.EAR. Or they can just see all of the Gaza reporting at GazaReport.com.
Great. Harry, thanks again for joining me in studio today. Good luck with the rest of your tour here in Canada, and good luck with the talk in Hamilton tonight.
Thank you. Have a good day.
This is Progressive Voices on 93.3 CFMU Radio. Progressive Voices is also available online at news site rabble.ca. You can access Progressive Voices at www.rabble.ca/podcasts/progressive-voices, where you can find all of the show's episodes uploaded as MP3 files. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Take care, and I'll talk to you next week.